Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
I'm usually a happy drunk, but I clearly had a relapse of like rage and all that stuff. And so I had to really sit myself down and be like, you got to get your shit together.
This is Death, Sex, and Money.
Hey, Dad, can I borrow some money?
The show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot.
We never had sex.
And need to talk about more.
You know, I don't know why people are so down on funerals.
I'm Anna Sale. When writer Michael Arsenault was 6 years old, his uncle Daniel died of complications from AIDS.
So that was when I was introduced to what AIDS meant and what, by extension, I was introduced to the word faggot.
Where did you hear the word faggot?
At home. It was a drunken rant from my dad after the funeral.
Around that same time, Michael was starting to figure out that he was gay. He didn't tell anyone.
You know, this is 1990, in the early 90s. My only points of references are my uncle Daniel dying, Men on Film in a Living Color, which was the effeminate gay male stereotype, so they were to be mocked and laughed at, and then movies like Philadelphia, where, again, you die of AIDS. So it wasn't, that's all I had. So imagine, and I grew up Catholic, so I was screwed up, to say the least.
Michael's religious upbringing and later conflicts with his parents about his sexuality inspired the title of his first book. It's called I Can't Date Jesus, Love, Sex, Family, Race, and Other Reasons I've Put My Faith in Beyonce.
I went to church recently, like a year ago, the first time in 5 Beyonce albums, which is about 15 years for people who are not familiar. 15 years.
Michael is a walking encyclopedia of 90s and 2000s R&B. And he's really funny. But his book also goes into deeply personal and painful territory about having to hide being gay from his Catholic mother and having to endure physical abuse at the hands of his dad. Michael and I talked soon after his book came out last year, right after he'd taken a trip home to Houston.
I drove to my parents' house. I talked to my mom. And so I was saying, you're like, not to be a bragger, but I was like, I made the New York Times bestseller list. And her response was like, I don't want you to go to hell. And I was like, well, I want you to be proud of me. She checked me. It's like, number one, I'm always proud of you because you're intelligent. So as of now, that's just where we are.
Yeah. Well, I want to go back to when you were a kid in Houston. And I want to be able to picture, can you describe the neighborhood you grew up in? What was it like?
It was one of those neighborhoods, I think maybe like 30, 40 years ago, white people lived there and then they left. And so, you know, what happens typically when they leave it was not the worst, but it still was like the hood. You know, we had burglar bars on the house. You know, I've heard a few gunshots, a lot of ruckus, although a lot of time the ruckus was coming from my house. It was a chaotic setting because of my father, his drinking, his anger. People would come to our house. They would smoke, drink, play dominoes, sometimes fight. Apparently, sometimes knives would be pulled or other things. And then usually, when something happened outside, it would come into the house, or something from his childhood or something else would be triggered. Then all of the chaos in our house would happen. And by chaos, I mean my dad being drunk, angry, yelling, screaming, arguing with my mom, and potentially getting violent and us jumping in.
With your mom?
Yes.
Were you afraid of your father as a boy?
Yes, but I would fight him off my mom. I had this recurring nightmare where my dad is attacking my mom and he goes to kill her because he would threaten to kill her and sometimes us. And I'm reaching to stop it, but I can't. And so then I wake up and that's it ends. So like in the night she dies and I wake up and I'm stuck. So that was a nightmare that followed me.
You couldn't save your mom in your dream.
Yeah, I couldn't save her. You know, despite how a lot of that sounds, there was still some joy in the house. I'll say people are complicated. My dad would take us fishing. I have really good memories of that. He tried. I don't think he had the language or the capability to do a lot of things because of how he grew up. He was abused himself, trying to actually defend his mom. Usually sometimes he would break down and cry after an episode and try to explain what happened to him. While that definitely added context, I also kind of, even as a kid, found it, maybe I didn't use the word manipulative, but that was the feeling, because what does it matter if you're then in turn doing the same thing to my mother and to us? I have complicated feelings, obviously, about my dad, but I love him, but he was a terror, I would say. But there was a tenderness there, but it's just the anger always kind of superseded because of the alcohol and because of the not really dealing with any of that stuff that happened to him.
Michael's been trying to deal with the stuff that happened to him as a kid, and it hasn't been easy. Therapy's been hard to afford regularly. It's expensive just living day to day in New York, where he's based now. And Michael's writing career took some time to get going. It started with media internships during a summer when he was in college, but they were unpaid, which meant he had to take out more in student loans. They got him to New York, though, where he'd spend his nights going to gay clubs for the first time.
I did not sneak out like people in high school because, again, I was fighting the obvious for a long time. But then when I was an intern at 20, I was 21, the younger brother of a high school classmate, took me to a gay club in the Village. I remember walking in and being like, why are they dancing together? And he's like, bitch, because they're gay. Like, we're in a gay club. Did you forget where I take you? I'm paraphrasing, but I did get a bitch. Like, are you serious? So I was a little confused at first. And then I got drunk and Destiny's Child came on, Lose My Breath, and select B-Day tracks. So it was both. And I remember when I finally let go, I started dancing because I used to be uncomfortable dancing in public because I think it gave it away.
That you're gay.
Yeah, one of my friends was like, oh, you dance like a faggot. And she meant it as a compliment because she's of the community. But the time I was like, oh, why did you tell me that? But once I was in the club and, you know, Liquid Courage, I felt free and I felt less inhibited. I was less aware. Like, I enter a space and I just look at everything. And I just get so caught up in my head. That also might just be some hood shit to watch your surroundings. But that's what it was. And once, like, you get the liquor, you're like, oh, stop thinking. Just go twerk. So, yeah, I was dancing, had fun.
Were you dancing by yourself?
By myself at first and then just with friends and then back to myself. But that was the first time I actually felt joy with that part of myself. Because it was really the first time I got to experience it and not have to worry about anything. It felt really nice.
When you think about yourself as a young man in your early 20s, out starting to go to gay clubs, when you were kind of scanning the crowd and checking people out, were you thinking about who you wanted to have sex with or who you might fall in love with or a combination?
I was called out recently about being apparently a bit of romantic. I was like, ugh, fuck you for saying that. But it's actually kind of true. So I'm horny all the time, but You know, I do prefer, for the first time I had sex, I wanted it to be a lovey-dovey situation with somebody I really cared about. Because I think if I love you, then that means I'm more comfortable. If I'm more comfortable, I'll have more fun. So there was a boy that I liked around that time who I wanted to have sex with. I gave him head. I was like, teach me. And he laughed at me, but that's, I'm just.
Did he teach you? Did he give you tips?
He did. I thought I did a good job, first effort. But he wouldn't let me do more, and we didn't have sex. And then I found out he was dating somebody. I was like, oh, here we go. A girl and a dude. I was like, oh, God, I'm a Mary J. Blige album mixed with, like, a 90s, like, Ricky Lake episode. Ain't this some fuck shit? This was ridiculous. And so, yeah, how I lost my virginity was very anticlimactic, but ideally, I wanted it to be lovey-dovey.
Does it feel like now you're in your mid-30s, when you think about...
mid. Oh, wait, 34 is mid. Go ahead. Sorry. I just had a mini crisis. I was like, that's next year. Excuse you.
You're not at the exact middle.
I am barely 34. I'm approaching mid-30s, yes.
The bridge from early to mid-30s.
Yes.
So you're in your mid-30s now. When you think about what you're looking for in your love life, is it the same? Is it that same kind of tenderness?
No, I mean, you know, it didn't necessarily have to be. I just wanted tender. Like, I just wanted someone to be kind and understanding for the first time. I don't, you know, I don't necessarily need, you know, tender kisses. Why am I quoting Tracy Spencer? I don't need that at all times. But in the beginning, yeah, I think for now the thing is I would actually like to finally have a boyfriend and not just situationships and dating. And I think one thing that I don't like about myself in the past is that I am so good at turning it off. And I also thought marriage was something that might trap you. So even, you know, before it was like a legal right, finally, I questioned whether I would even do such a thing because I saw what it did to my parents. So it was sometimes easy for me to kind of create this false sense of intimacy with unavailable people. Because I did have a moment where I finally had to admit to myself, you are attracting unattainable people because you are unattainable. You are vocalizing that you purportedly want a boo thing and to have a boyfriend and do all those things, but look who you surround yourself with. Look who you ignore. Look how easy it is for you to cut people off. And so the physical intimacy issue was one thing, but it was also like I wasn't giving a real fight to have a meaningful connection. Changing my mindset has already yielded different results. I'm not that far away from having something that is finally real and mine.
Can you give me an example of how changing your mindset has concretely changed your behavior? Are you looking in different places?
Yeah, I treat dating and the men I might meet with more effort, I guess. I will still clip you, you know, but...
Wait, what's that mean?
Like, clip somebody, like, just get rid of them. Like, we're done. It's not gonna work. And it's not so much because I'm looking for a reason to get people out, but it's also like, you know what, I don't think you would be good for me or I wouldn't be good for you. So, like, you know, let's move on. If I know it's gonna be a headache, if I know it's gonna have me ended up listening to, I don't know, sad Mary J. Blige albums like Sade or like Amy Winehouse, because I don't want to be curled up in a ball listening to, I don't know, Wake Up Alone. No, I don't need those problems. I'm like trying to hit Faith Evans' notes on Mary J. Blige, I never want to live without you. It's like, no. If I see something, I'm like, let me get out. Yeah. Mm-mm. That's growth for me.
It's interesting because you, like, you're at once describing yourself as someone who would, like, shut it down when you felt vulnerable or could feel someone not responding to you in the way that you wanted to be responded to and not be emotionally available and also wrapped up in the fetal position listening to Mary J. Blige.
Well, you know, I will say it takes me a long time to get to that point. I have a high tolerance for pain. It takes a while for me to cry. And I don't say that as... to be something to be proud of. I actually think that's not a good thing. But I think growing up the way that I did, I already kind of knew how to suspend stuff sometimes. Because, again, like, stuff was happening in the house and I had to go outside and go to school and present. So I kind of have built up, you know, a certain endurance and for all of that and intolerance. But, you know, I'm human. So when I finally get to that point, oh, I'm there.
I
Coming up, more about Michael's dating life today and why he always carries a condom. Well, almost always.
I used to keep a condom in my wallet all the time and was not having sex. And then when I finally got over, I didn't have it in my wallet. I was so mad recently about that. I blew it. I blocked my blessing.
Last week, we shared some of your stories about your relationship with alcohol. What's working for you when it comes to drinking and what isn't. For our listener, Brandy, the timing of our episode really hit home. She just started talking more openly with friends about her drinking habits.
I did not realize how much I've been consuming, and having me share that I may clear a whole bottle of wine a night and not even think about it, and the shock on their face is like, oh girl, no, you know, that's not what we do. Has been a real eye opener.
Brandy says she's looking forward to hearing your answers to the follow-up question we asked, which is, what do you do when the craving for alcohol strikes and you don't want to indulge? Here's a little of what we've heard so far.
I've gotten really into craft non-alcoholic beer.
I'll usually splurge on something.
I go out on the balcony and I take some time to actually relax instead of just chemically relaxing.
We still want to hear from more of you about this. Send us a voice memo about what you've done instead of drink when the urge hits. Keep it to 30 seconds or so, and you can email it to us at deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. Let me tell you a good story. It was late on a Sunday afternoon, and my family and I had been away and rolled into the driveway, and everyone was worn out from traveling and getting hangry. But waiting for us was a solution. A Hungry Root box filled with healthy, grabbable snacks and a few different dinner meals to choose from. We tore into this thing like a pack of wild animals and ate all the snacks. But they were healthy, whole ingredients, fresh produce. And then we were set for dinner a few hours later, which only took about 15 minutes to prep and cook and get on the table. I was so grateful to my past self for doing my current self this solid by ordering this box. And it was easy. I took a short quiz to tell Hungry Root what kinds of meat my family eats, the sorts of flavors we like, any dietary restrictions we have, or just things we're trying to avoid, and when I wanted the box to be delivered. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Death, Sex, and Money listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/DSM to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/DSM. And don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home.
and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on death, sex, and money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM+ to get access wherever you listen. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. After losing his uncle to AIDS when he was a young kid, Michael Arsenault was hyper aware of the health risks that can come with sex. And he says the threat of HIV and AIDS continues to hang over his dating life.
When people talk about the HIV-AIDS crisis, they tend to talk about it as if it's like past tense, particularly for queer men. I am Black, so Black and Latinx men have really high rates, as do Black women, but it's overwhelmingly high for people like me, and my dating pool is a lot smaller as a result. So it's very much still a crisis for me. And I've quietly seen many people drop off, and people
really
still don't talk about
it. Die of AIDS.
Yeah, die of AIDS.
Who are your peers?
Yeah, people younger than me or people around my age. But there are plenty of people still dying.
This might be a personal question, but given that how you learned about sex and gay sex was during the AIDS crisis,
mm-hmm.
Have you chosen to use PrEP?
I have not. Well, so that's, when I first moved here 5 years ago, I went to the doctor and asked about it. She said I wasn't the ideal candidate, basically because I wasn't fucking enough.
Oh, no.
It was kind of like it was kind of the equivalent
of... You're not having enough casual sex.
Yeah. Yeah, I wasn't having enough sex, apparently. Now I just kind of need to figure that out. I think I am open to that because it came up in conversation recently because I didn't have a condom, so I didn't have sex. So, yeah.
Have you, and this is another personal question, but have you ever had sex without a condom?
No.
No.
No, 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 no. I have not. And no judgment to you who have had whatever, whatever, whatever. When you see someone die like that very early and then you see other people die along the way and you see people die that are still your age and then in some cases when they don't have the money to bury someone, so it's like in a wooden casket, when you know of these things or have seen these things, for me at least, that doesn't leave you. So I have never had sex without a condom. There was one instance where it almost, but that was stopped. Like, it was stopped. Yeah, it was stopped. Because I quickly...
You stopped it?
Yeah. I had to catch myself. Because when you're drunk and... Or at least even tipsy, you know, some stuff happens. But no, that's how it happens, you know? And while you can, you know, lead a full, healthy life, all those things, if I can prevent it, I will prevent it. So I've never had sex without a condom.
You've described over your sort of childhood and adulthood, like basically like the coping mechanisms you've formed and then how you've tried to adjust them as you've gotten older. And one of the things you talked about with your dad's drinking and his violence, how have you thought about alcohol and what feels comfortable for you in terms of when it feels fun to let go and when does it feel scary?
So I've never not, well, I've been constantly reminded, so I'm never not cognizant of the fact that arsenal men can drink. A lot of them have, a lot of us have really high tolerances, or so we tell ourselves. Well, yeah, we do. And, but subsequently, I'm very much aware of how addiction runs in the family. So I didn't drink until 21, the same way I didn't really go, I didn't go to a club until 21. And for the most part, I've been fine, but I have been concerned in the past because I'm reminded that that can lead to something else. And so a couple years ago, there was a moment where I was drunk and I became incredibly angry at somebody. And I removed myself from that situation, but I was so enraged. And then I am kicking over trash cans. I'm pushing like the newspaper stands down. I was kicking white people's bikes in that area down. And I'm assuming that way because it was the village. But I could be wrong. I was kicking somebody's bikes down. I was losing my shit. And mind you, I'm black, lanky in the village. I could have easily been arrested or something. And then who knows what could have happened. And so I was really ashamed of that. And it scared me because it reminded me that no matter what I tell myself, I am still human and thus susceptible to falling into patterns of those who have come before me. I have not had an incident like that since then because I'm actually more of a fun drunk. But again, I grew up in a house with a lot of anger. And so you know, for me, I'm actually more like my mom. She can be chill and just take it and take it and take it. And then when she blow up, duck. And so that's how a lot of times I can be. So it takes a while, but when I blow up, I blow up. But then I have a bit of my father in me. And I wasn't proud of that. It was very scary. But I had to learn from that because at that point I was 30. So I knew better, but I still did it. And that's when I had to really pause and be like, you can't be acting like this. And you need to watch what you drink.
And did you change the way you drink after that night?
Yeah, I never got that drunk again. But also, I just took better care of my emotions. My mom is the strongest person I know, but she comes from the school of thought that you don't really tell your business. You don't. You keep that in and you deal with it because that's what she was taught. My dad, clearly, he just blurts out stuff in anger. But I didn't want to continue that cycle. It didn't necessarily change overnight. But eventually I had reached this point where I thought I needed to make peace or as much peace as possible with them. Because if I don't, I'm going to carry this with me. I think in order to truly forgive people, you have to just meet people where they are. And so with my dad, what I started doing was just to call him. Just we don't talk long. He talks like a mile a minute. Hey, that boy, you all right? All right, love you, bye. And even like love you, I got him to say love you because I would be like, love you, Pop, and then hang up. Huh. We would only talk for a minute. He would ask about the weather. You need anything? You all right? But I think even just calling and ending with I love you means a lot to him. And so it's good for me that I do that because it shows that like, I have forgiven as much as, you know, well, no, I've forgiven. I'm not going to quantify. I've forgiven. I've made peace with as much as I can. I'm not carrying with me all that anger. You know, this is very, you know, early Celine Dion ballad of me or Mariah Carey, but you can heal from that and you can grow and you can be happy.
That's Michael Arsenault. His book of essays is called I Can't Date Jesus, and he's working on his next book called I Don't Want to Die Poor. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. Our team includes Katie Bishop, Annabelle Bacon, Zandra Allen, Emily Botine, and Andrew Dunn. Stephanie Joyce and Joanna Solotaroff also worked on this episode, and our intern is Emily Nadal. The Reverend John Delore and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. Thanks to the Buffalo Bills Center of the West in Cody, Wyoming for the use of their studio. I'm on Twitter at Anna Sale. The show is at Death Sex Money on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And you can always email us at deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. Michael also wrote a piece in the New York Times last year called The Student Loan Serenity Prayer. It's wonderful, and there's a link on our website at deathsexmoney.org. Michael owes more than $50,000 in student loans, and he told me he regrets borrowing so much and not telling people back in high school that he's gay.
In hindsight, I wish I came up sooner because I won one of my best friends in high school, like at least $20,000. It was a queer scholarship, and she ain't dated a woman since the 90s. And so
wait, so you wrote an essay for your friend who got a $20,000 queer scholarship.
Yeah, a PFLAG scholarship, actually. And that was money, because it was, we had a hood high school, so it was like, oh no, black, gay at this place? All the money.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.